Well, good morning. So guys, I want to start with that first slide of the world. Can you put that up? And I can click from there. There we go. All right, look, before I start, let me tell you how I used to do this. You know, you go through a lot of economic analysis and where the nations are. And what Dennis has asked me to do is basically tell you, where's the world today economically? What are we really up against? What are we facing in these times? And rather than put a bunch of squiggly lines up, and I got David and Uli here, I got to be careful what I put up anyway. I'm going to try to just get this down to 40 minutes of what you need to know. Then we can maybe get into some questions and answers later. But here's what I want to do. I want to give you a little bit of peace. I want you to look at that map of the world. And you'll find your place in it and where you are and where your regions are. And what Dennis and Mark and others are doing with the Global Council of Nations, the Statesman's Project. And I want you to stop and just take a deep breath and realize that God created this. This belongs to God. You and I belong to God. He has a plan, and he's got it. You know, we were born into this age for a purpose. And we're going to talk about the ages here in a minute and what's really spiritually going on. But you don't have to be anxious. You don't have to be worried. And so as you're going through this, think about, okay, what is my role? What am I called to do? And you know your role partially by your passion and where you're from. And what you know God's asked you to do. And he will give you the tools you need to fulfill your destiny that he had in mind for you before you were born. That's all you have to know, and that's all you have to think about. And be obedient. So the prayer is, God, help me to discern my role in your plan that you had in mind when you created all this. And help me to be obedient to that call. Take a deep breath, and it's as easy as breathing. Okay, so as we go through that, keep that in mind. Now, where are we? We find ourselves in a world of debt, deficits, and mismanagement of currencies to the point that it's insanity, really, in that liberal and conservative economists, whether you're a progressive or a free enterprise advocate, we're in agreement that you can't print and borrow forever. Why? Now, let's think about that a minute. You and I believe that God created the universe and there's a purpose. He's a living God. He's got his hands on this and he cares about us individually. This isn't like the Greeks thought, it's Mount Olympus and the gods created this and said, well, I wonder how that's all working out down there. It's not like that. And so if there is a personal God with a personal a purpose, would you be able to print and borrow forever without any controls or circumstances? No. Why? Because then it's just simply a matter of governments convening and deciding how to print money and distribute it. And then it would be the collective intellect of mankind would be able to manage their own affairs without God's laws or purposes or principles as they saw fit through government. Now, not to get into what progressives think and who their God is, you cannot print and borrow forever, or there is no need for God's plan. So these debts and deficits have got to stop somewhere at some time. Now, where are we on those things? Where do I click this? Right here? All right. There's the world's debt today projected through 2019. The gross world product is about $88 trillion. That's 193 nations, states, produce about that much projected GDP, gross domestic product. World government debt today is estimated at $244 trillion. Now, that's public debt. That's debt on that's a debt instrument paying a coupon punch, meaning it's called. I'm not talking about contingent liabilities. Uli does a great presentation on contingent liabilities. That number, 244, is just the United States on future debt obligations. I'm talking about debt on debt like you and I are used to. You buy a car, you borrow money, your house, you got a debt, your debt instrument, it has an interest rate, it's payable. Look at the ratio, guys, of debt to GDP. The normal standard for economists in measuring that is that world a sovereign debt should not go over 110%. And this is about three times. We have pushed debt beyond any reasonable economic equation in the world today. And the world government deficits are $98 trillion on $88 trillion in GDP, so we continue to add fuel to the fire. Now, when I get through this, the United States is no better. We're sitting on about $20 trillion in GDP and $22 trillion in debt. Congress just passed a budget that is currently $1.1 trillion in arrears, meaning deficit. Well, the United States spends about $4.75 trillion on $3.65 trillion in income. And the projections of the future for the next 10 years are going to $30, $40 trillion in debt. Okay, now remember the proposition I gave you in the beginning. If you can print and borrow forever, there's no need to even worry about any of the stuff we're talking about. There's no need to read the Bible. There's no need to worry about proper structure. There's no need to think about the discipline of the curriculum of a sheep nation, how you manage God's assets properly for the good of the people. Just forget it all. Print and borrow. Convene in a Congress, a parliament, or a government and say, how are we going to distribute what we can create? That is the devil's lie. And we're getting to this point now where it's about out of control. All right, this is the only squiggly lines I'll give you today. Milton Friedman was one of my mentors. I had the undeserved privilege of traveling with him. He is who taught me basic economics and application. And he was a brilliant man, by the way. And he believed in God. We talked about that some, but another day's story. This is a theory that he had he couldn't prove. He believed, like when Einstein had a theory of relativity and he couldn't prove it until you could get in space and show the difference in the atomic clocks, number one, or that light responds to gravity by total eclipse. You had to have a spacecraft to do it. But he predicted all that. And after his death, it was proven. Milton Friedman had a theory that when you borrow and consume, when governments, sovereign governments, consume 10% in borrowings of the GDP and the work of the labor of the people, interest rates have to rise. In other words, you can't borrow money forever and not have rates go up. And this was his chart. Now, this is what, let's see if I can get this to work here. Where is the, looking for the, oh, here, I use mine. I say I will. Well, this debt wall is predicted on, we tested this. In 2009, when we had the world meltdown, if you can see 2009 here at the bottom of the chart, quantitative easing was tried for the first time. Congress brought the Federal Reserve before a hearing and asked them, why did you do it? And basically the answer was to keep interest rates low. And so QE1 was when they implemented the first quantitative easing, and it was $600 billion. The question they never ask them is, why $600 billion? Why that number? And when you go back and do the calculations, $600 billion is exactly the number it took to back them off that orange line, which is 10% of the world's GDP. And that bright, thanks, really, you got a pointer? Oh, thanks, there you go. We get it to the rescue, thanks. There, right there. And they did it, and it didn't work. They had to come back again later and put up another $600 billion, and then it stabilized a little bit. And then in 2012, we're back on this line, and we've been doing quantitative easing ever since. And this is the debt wall that Friedman predicted. It's a wall that means you can borrow money, you can continue to do it, but you can't keep interest rates low. There's a reaction and an opposite reaction to these things. Interest rates react to borrowing and supply. It's basic economics. You can't distort it, you can't bend it any more than if I drop this right now, it's going to fall because of gravity. I can't will it away, I can't make it not happen. And this is basically what you need to know is that governments have borrowed money now. As of 2012, we're out here in the twilight zone. We don't know where this is going or how long it can last. There's an elasticity in this because the United States dollar is the world's currency right now, being stressed mightily, in my opinion. But at some point, this has to end. But this, in my opinion, proves up, guys, Milton Friedman's theories going back to, late 70s. All right. Well, let me come back to that in just a second. Now, what does all this mean for us today? And how did we get to this point? I'm going to try this pad here, and I'm going to try to show you where I think. Let's go ahead and put the iPad up. And I had written up here on another one. There it is. Biblical relationships of God, mankind, and government. I've had an interesting life experience in these things, dealing with governments, trying to understand how did we get to this point. And let me try to do this quickly to stay on my time frame of what it is I want to tell you. There have been seven of these relationships, what I call basically covenant relationships of God and man and government, to understand how he wanted governments to work for the benefit of society. Now, why are we in this system of things? Why create it and let the world fall? Well, we all know this, and I'm giving you a basic biblical analysis here, 101. So we could learn how to live with him forever in the kingdom. We're learning through this system of things to how to choose him over anything else and not make the mistake that Adam and Eve made, who chose something other than God's laws. And we're learning that. And through these experiences, we've learned them. Okay, who were the seven? Well, Israel. Well, let's see, that doesn't work. Okay, guys, bear with me. Here we go. Egypt, if you can read that. Greece, Rome, the Holy Roman Empire, if you can remember what that means. Europe, and the United States. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't other great countries. China, Persia, the Incas, pick the country, any African country. What this definition is that at one time in the history of the world, this was the center of the known world, either in banking, finance, communications, military power, and laws. And as we've talked about this, every time we learn something, good or bad, we've drug it forward. Now, above the line and below the line, what did we learn? Well, there's another presentation about this. Egypt, collective farming, Greece, city-states, Rome, Republic, Holy Roman Empire, the application of theocracy, Europe, was the first globalization of the world, and the transition from kings to the United States, which was free enterprise. So I want to talk about these bookends here in a minute about where we are. And then where are we today in this time? We are in an economic age. And I don't know if it's 5 days or 5 years, 50 years or 500 years. I'm not an eschatologist, and I rely on Dennis and others for that. But we are in an economic age that there will never be another country on this timeline that dominates the world unless it changes the entire world. And everything we've learned since the beginning of Israel. Now, it's not by accident that the center of this, by the way, is Rome and where Jesus entered the world. And there have been, well, I left my other notes, see if I can do this from memory. The prior ages were military, religion, and government, and now economics, and that's where we are. Let me see what slides I brought on that. And government is politics. I know this is hard, I'm trying to learn to use this with you. I could change colors of this in a minute, but basically, I don't need to go through these ages, but you can, for today's presentation, but military was, and each got shorter. Military, then there's a crossover to religion, which is the Holy Roman Empire. I do have charts on this, guys. I can do a little better than this. Politics, then it got a little shorter, which was Europe. And then the last age we're in now, and we're still in it, is the economic age. And see how it gets shorter each time. So what does that age mean? It means that in the military age, conflict in the world and anything that changed culture was based upon a military component or analysis. When we got to the religious age, it was religion. Martin Luther, others. I mean, the society and the cultural change changed on religion. Europe and the unification of Europe and the EU was politics, coming out of World War I and World War II, restructuring the world after, basically after World War I, which was, and all these ages are tied together. You learn something from each one, and what you pull forward is the good, and then we ignore the bad, and I'm going to tell you what that is here in a minute. Then, United States. And we're in an age of the United States that, it, in my opinion, can't happen by accident. Now think about this a minute. The United States of America has all the marbles, all of them. There's nothing that we don't have in our control in my country. Strongest military, only military since Rome that was worldwide or the known world at the time and enforced basically the law. Second, banking, the largest market, largest consumer market. World's currency, basically the world's language, which came out of England and Europe, and media, film, movies, our influences are basically dominant. Now, what have we done wrong? The Lord gave us each one of these for a reason. You learn something from each one of them, something good, which is on the bottom line down here when I do these things. But what was negative? What was the common negative thing about each one of them? What happened to each one of these civilizations that they collapsed? They abandoned God. They refused to follow, at some point, God's laws on government. And then we went on to the next one. You learned that. You took the good with it. You learned that example, and you moved on. Now, I'm going to be a little critical of my own country today because we've made two mistakes. We made one mistake in 1776 that was our mandate and destiny that we didn't honor. And we're still paying for it, but we're doing better. But what was it? We didn't free everybody at independence. There should have been no slaves. The Indians should have had, Native Americans should have had full citizenship. Should have dealt with it right then. Alexander Hamilton wanted to. Lawrence and some of his compatriots wanted that. There's a reason why the word slavery is not in the Constitution. They debated it. And Hamilton and others said, it's not going to be in there because someday this is comprehensive rights of man. What do you think Thomas Jefferson penned when he wrote that? All men are created equal with unalienable rights of God, coming from God, the Creator. We should have done it right then. Abraham Lincoln comes along, we have a civil war, and he talked about it in his second inaugural address about the price and of the sin of the country. And he didn't lay it off on the South. He said, this is a United States of America problem. We're solving it here today, and the Union will survive. And just like ancient Israel, God forgave as long as there were those praying and working to solve the problem. Now, there's one thing the United States is doing today that I can't explain. I detest it because we have in our ability right now to solve all the world's economic problems. All we have to do is balance the budget, start paying down the debt a little bit. It could be a 100-year pay down. But if you balance the budget and paid one physical real dollar, not a reduction in the growth of the government on the debt, then the dollar would be as good as gold. It would stabilize the world. And everybody else would have to reform in their banking systems to that principle. Yet what do? We continue to run the deficits. We continue to distort our own currency. And in my opinion, it's not biblical. And not only is it not biblical, we are distorting our authority impacting the rest of the world by distorting our currency. Because any developing country that gets into this situation has to pay a higher price to buy and sell in dollars, primarily in oil, other world commodities. The exchange alone is sometimes 7 or 8%. You and I, there's a reason why in the Constitution, it is unconstitutional for the government to tax one person different than another. It's one of the few things in the Constitution that the federal government can't do to individuals. Why? Because you destroy them. If I can tax you at 10 and I'm at 8, sooner or later that 2% makes up the difference, and your business doesn't make it and mine does. That's what we're doing in the rest of the world today by mismanaging our currency. Now, before I move on, let me make the point, though, of where we are on this thing. I'm still on red. We abandon God, and we're in that situation right now if we're not careful, if we don't repent. But what happened in this chart, ladies and gentlemen? In the beginning of government relationships, you know, there were some societies before Israel. There was a sea people that they still know who it was that attacked Egypt in 1180 BC. All remnants of the Great Flood, in my opinion. But the point is, the first government-ordained covenant relationship dominant on this axis of civilization was God and Israel, and God lived among them. And they were at peace, and there were laws on how to handle that economically, how to take care of the ports, all in there. Doug Jaden, Dennis, others can tell you this on how this all works. But God lived among them, and what did the people do? We want a king. He says, you won't like it. He said, well, no, we want a king. We've always had kings. There's a king. We've got to have a king. And so God said, I'll give you one. And it starts with Saul, and you know the story. So in ancient Israel, God was with them. And they asked for a king. When the United States came online at the end of the seven cycles, the world was dominated by kings. Birth was destiny. You couldn't escape your place in life. That's one of the problems with kings, socialism or communism. It distorts your direct contact to God and your destiny and the choices you make for your life and your family that you go to God for, not government. That's what this is all about. God is your answer, not government, and you and your family and your church. In the United States, we had a king. And we asked for God. And there was the total cycle. And this is where we are today, trying to make that transition. And the world is fighting that theme, and will continue to. Now, what else happens here? Now, who would you expect in this age, if you're in an age of economics, and you're in the final stage of the relationship of government and God, what would you expect the debate to be about? Communism versus capitalism. There are only two countries in the world today in control of their own destiny, have any chance of orchestrating their own future: the United States of America and China. Everybody else in between has to react. What's going on today is this. I put this chart up to kind of give you I need to go back to the charts if I could. There, that chart. Now, the reason if I gave yours right, oh, great. I put this chart up to show you the disparity of the size of the two economies. I gave you the world numbers of 88 trillion. When you graph it, there's the United States up there around 20 trillion. Here's China over here around 12 to 15 trillion. And look at every other country in the world. Look. They're way down here. Next is Japan, Germany, UK, France, all under 5 trillion. When you graph it, it is a cliff from the United States to the next developed economy. Everybody down here, 172 countries at 1 trillion or less in GDP. That's most of the world. China over here is a communist system. This everything in between here, and I'm going to bore you with these details, but communism approaches capital and currency totally different than the United States. We tax profits up. There's private ownership. You're in business. We tax you. If there's not enough money, we borrow money through T-bills. We run deficits like we're running right now of $1.1 trillion. But it's on the books. You can see it. It's part of the system. The money is being managed through a Federal Reserve. In China, they have a five-year communist plan. And they dictate to the provinces what it will be in advance. The provinces pay forward their federal budget tax, not from profits. It's like a lease payment. Like you go lease a piece of property, and you got to go make enough money to pay for it. And when it comes time to pay the bill, they've got to make it up on the ground. Now, I did know Deng Xiaoping. I think I told some of you that. And I had this discussion with him in 1991. I helped reopen the Shanghai Stock Exchange in 1991. That was my job, other than being a backdoor emissary for President Bush right after Tiananmen Square. He was a great man. I enjoyed getting to know him. But the debate we had was, I said, you can do this, Chairman, but if you do, your currency will never be tradable on a world market. And he said, I don't know. Well, I'll agree to disagree with you on that. I said, it won't work. And here was, I'll never forget this quote he gave me. Chinese communism will work economically because the Chinese people will do what I tell them. They'll borrow when I tell them to borrow. They'll buy what I tell them to buy. They'll live where I tell them to live, so on and so forth. I said, well, maybe. I really can't dispute that. But I said, the West won't do it. I said, it's not in our DNA, and we're too far down the line to change to have that kind of system. I did not get to discuss Christ with him. I did some other Chinese leaders at the time. This issue was strictly economic analysis. So here we are, 30 years forward from that discussion. Now think about this statement. If this is true, China is that big an economy against the United States in relationship to the entire rest of the world, why doesn't anybody want their currency, including themselves? It's because no one knows what it's worth. Harvard just did an analysis on this and thinks it's about maybe as much as 20% misvalued. And that's too much. That's why oil's not priced in yuans. That's why the euro, when we get to the debt, and I told you about the debt. There's a whole other presentation on this on debt. And I'll get to that in interest rates in a minute. But when you have more debt than you have income, you're restricted in your choices. And that's what's happened to Europe today in simplest terms. Now, the euro is a tradable currency. I mean, the Greek drachma is a tradable currency because it's based upon a Federal Reserve system of bookkeeping. You know how many are out there in circulation. If there's a dead asset, it's written off, not in China. You had a bank fail in China last week, a rather large bank. And we don't know. They don't report. We don't know what the debt of the banks are. We don't know what their total debt is. They have their own banking system. Their own World Bank, their own IMF. But here's what they're trying to do, what I call the Chinese shadow. They're buying their way across all of these countries, not yet in Europe, but these countries below by 1.1 trillion. By the way, there are 18 countries in the world with a GDP of about 18 trillion, and they could survive if they didn't have so much debt. Brazil, India, these are major economies, but their debt is suffocating. And their maneuverability is getting less and less as they continue to run deficits. Now, the only way, and this is a stark statement, but there is no way that these two systems can coexist compatibly because you can't coordinate the currencies. You never know what things cost in China in component parts versus what it cost in the West. And so they're operating worldwide in dollars right now. But they're trying to get into yuans because that is something they can control through a communist theory. Last point I'll make to you as my time is getting short. In the United States, and in all Western countries, banks get up in the morning and report to the Fed the activity on their bank. What is the demand for capital? And the Federal Reserve system, of which there are regions, make a determination of how much money to put back into the system. It's called monetary policy, and they dial the dials up, trying to keep interest rates constant and avoid inflation, okay? In China, the banks report to the federal government what they want to hear for the communist plan, because if they don't, they get fired. So they don't know. Now, before you think I'm beating up on China too much, I blame us. We could fix this by balancing our budget and managing our currency. And then here's a new thought that came to me during this conference that I hadn't used before. It came to me, and she was when I was talking to you. You actually made me think of this. The G7, the group of seven nations, was formed in a year. I'm going to give you the year here in a minute. for the purpose of coordinating currencies who aren't on the gold standard, so they could all print money. And this is before this is before the EU. Each one of them have their own currencies: a mark, a yen, a buck, and a pound. Okay, and so they could coordinate their currencies and run deficits without being inflationary. No currencies on the gold standard today. Up until 1974, every currency in every economy, through those seven government relationships I gave you, there was some hard commodity behind the currency which restricted the kings or anybody else from just printing money and blowing up the economy, because they couldn't do it. As Milton Friedman used to say to me, you have to tell members of Congress, this was his passion, and that was, if in the Middle Ages, when the kings had all the power and authority, they had serfs, they owned all the land, they controlled all the rents, they owned all the gold, they owned all the production, and their word in the morning was law, and they could change it, couldn't print and bar their way out of problems then, what makes you think the government can do it today? And that's where we are, yet we are in denial of this and keep kicking the can down the road 4 years or so because, well, that's just not tomorrow's problem yet. But I blame us. Now, what happened in China is I was part of the team that helped them with their intellectual property rights law. So I'll give that story that I told you. It's my turn in the barrel. There's several of us doing this, and we're trying to help them get into the 21st century with an intellectual property rights law. And I'm at the table, and my Chinese counterpart's across from me, and I'm going through, basically we're using the U.S. code, and we're going through and explaining how this stuff works. And this is a communist state that in 6,000 years, there have been no private ownership of physical assets. And the guy across from me is my age, and I noticed he turned white, literally like this, like white. So I thought he was ill. I turned to the translator. I said, well, if you need to take a break, let's take a break. I'm going to have to solve this today, you know. So we've got a year to get this done. and he said, okay, I want a break. And then the Chinese interpreter came to me and said, he wants to see you in executive session, which means just the two of us. And didn't know what my interpreter there. And this is off the record, just me and the Chinese. And he looked at me, and we got out in the hall, and I said, what? And he goes, well, I just have a question I need to ask you. And I need to ask this question so that I'm embarrassed to say it in front of the crowd. I said, okay, what? And here was the question. Tell me again how you can own a thought. And I realized then, I took a step back, I said, I get it. Inventions, music, any intellectual property that's not a physical asset, you can't understand private ownership. How can you own a thought? So I went back to members of Congress that were the Democrats in control at the time and said, they're not ready for this. This is not fair. You need to have a provisional status. Bring them into the World Trade Organization on a case-by-case basis. Help them with their system. Bring them into the world banking system, and don't just throw them on this altar of free enterprise. And they said, no, we can't. Now, this is U.S. leadership that did this. You know, there was a time when we could have helped more than we did. And we said, well, we'll figure it out along the way. Because they wanted to keep the economy going. They wanted to make sure there was no disruptions and, you know, that kind of thing. Kick the can down the road. No proper biblical discipline. And I said, I don't think it'll work. And I told them the Deng Xiaoping story. I said, this is where they're going with this. I've seen the books. And they went, well, no, we're not going to do it. And here we are today. And really, you know, China's just doing what it has to do to survive. They don't hate us like the Soviet Union did. They're trying to maintain an economic system that makes sense for them, and they're too deep into it now. They've got too much money out there in circulation. They've got too many people depending upon a middle-class lifestyle that they can't support, and they don't know what to do. Now, I need to finish this. I don't have time to tell you what's going to happen in the trade negotiations. But because I want to tell you about where all this impasse is going. So let me put one other thing. Give me my iPad back here, if you could, just for a second. And if you take that chart, how do I change colors? Oh, there it is. Okay. You got the USA here, and you got China here. And they're the only two systems in control of any currencies in the world. And it's what I call the Great Trough. and you're in, if you're $1 trillion or below, you're in this water down here, and you can't get out of it. You're barely treading water. And this is 172 countries, roughly, with less than $1 trillion in GDP, having to survive in either dollars or yuans, depending upon where they are in that shadow. And they can't earn them. They can't get there from here. It's what we as Christians have got to figure out for all of these, and this is about probably, I don't know, 4 billion people. They can't. There's no way they can do it themselves. And that's what we're trying to figure out. Someone do a trade system among Christians to help each other do this. But this is what's happening. And you've got a few countries up here above a trillion. But their debt is the problem. Okay, let's see what the next slide is. Give me the next slide. There. Now, you and Uli might have really seen this till he's sick of seeing it. This is Lacey Hunt's work out of Houston, Texas. And what this is the borrowing rate of United States currency from 1950. And actually, I got one that goes back to 1860. And it's about 4.2%. It's right in here, below 5%. That is the number, that is the average interest rate that the Fed is trying to dial up to keep everything moving on all cylinders. Now, why an interest rate? 20% of the U.S. economy is a bond market. The Teachers Retirement Fund of New York depends upon that constant interest rate. They're not looking for return on investment. They're not in the stock market. They want somebody to come along with an annuity, take their $20 billion fund, and give them enough money every year to pay the teacher's retirement. And it's supposed to be AAA rated bonds. And they haven't been able to hit that number on a borrowing rate since 2009. And there's a give and take, and therefore is the catch 22. You know what a catch 22 is? Catch 22 is a book, and basically it's you're in a bad situation. No matter what you do this, it makes this worse. You do this, it makes this worse. You're in a catch 22. It was a military term, but anyway, you get the point. And here's the situation. You can't borrow your way out of this. You can't print your way out of it. You can't inflate your way out of it because there's too much debt. And if you raise interest rates, then Brazil, India can't afford the debt. Maybe not the United States. You keep interest rates low too long, the bond market collapses or the economy doesn't grow. Now, here's another axiom that you can't refute. This is a law of economics that can't be distorted. You cannot have economic growth. You cannot have sustained economic growth without a cost of capital. It can't be done. And so the more you grow, interest rates rise. Until it becomes overheated, then you raise rates and it drops back down, and the Fed's always trying to keep you right there in that range. Okay? That's the catch 22. That's where we are today. Russia today is a remnant of the European covenant. They're the only European power trying to intervene somehow. They got about a $1.5 trillion economy. It's small. Their main export is oil. They manufacture a few things. They got a technical industry, but it isn't anyways penetrating the world market. So they're out there still, the old colonial empires with client states like Syria, certain areas of Africa, where they're still trying to meddle with the income they have from oil. China today is a conflict of relationships in an economic age that we partly caused. And the resolution is simple. You obey God's laws. You do what's necessary to get back in right alignment in the government. And you solve the problem. Now, okay, Dennis, I'm at 30 seconds. I promise I'm going to quit in about 2 minutes. So let me give you some hope on this. The overview of this was this. We live in an economic age. Those are the areas, military, religion, political, economic, that we've been through. The governments will continue to struggle balancing God's principles with the realities of a fallen world. What is now required is a new alliance and movement of Christian churches, businesses, and government leaders and political activists who believe in principle-based government policy and economic commerce. That's the Statesman. That's the Global Council of Nations. It's a trade platform in Oklahoma. It's us under the system implementing and obeying God's laws for discipline. Now, there's hope. Let me give you this one story. I never cease to be amazed at what God can do. I was asked to go to El Salvador to meet with the first Guatemalans from the country, but El Salvador for the same reason. What can we do to help get this economy going, given what I've just told you their troubles are, and stop immigration from outside their country? There's a new president there, a young man by 38 years old, by the name of Gabriela Bukele. So I'm in a meeting, before I meet with him, there's a conference. It's 550 pastors convened for the purpose of talking about what do we do for the good of El Salvador. Okay, so put yourself in this position, like we're talking about all your countries. And in comes President Bukele, takes the podium. Now, this is not a closed meeting. There's press, international press. The week before, he had met with the United States, Secretary of State Pompeo, in reference to what he's going to do about immigration. And he gets up and he gives a testimony that I have never, ever heard in my adult life of 50 years at national politics. He said, let me tell you how I got here. I said, I'm a businessman who made a lot of money at the age of 28, living a good life. Didn't talk about his faith too much, but he believed in God. And he said, a prophet came out of the El Salvador mountains, unknown. I'd never met this guy before. He said, I just heard a prophetic word from the Lord. I think you're supposed to run for president. And he goes, yeah, right. And that first reaction. And blew the guy off. About 2 or 3 months later, another prophet comes forward. Never been introduced to him. And he said, I know you've been told this, but I just got a clear word from the Lord. You're supposed to run for president. He says, I started to pay attention to this, but he still didn't believe it. Well, he'd never been in politics. He'd been a mayor as a servant, but had no desire for this and making a lot of money. He's young. What do I want to be in government for, particularly in this country? And then a third prophet came to him. Have you heard the story? Third prophet came to him. And he walked up. And he never met these guys. He didn't know them. And he walked up to him and he said, you do not want to make the mistake of being in the fourth space. Wow. Now, I've written about this in my Nutter report. That's a new term for me, the fourth space. And he stopped him. He said he felt it was important. Let's see if I can do this without being emotional. What is the fourth space? You don't want to be in the space where you have denied God three times. And he walked away. So he reconsidered. He runs. Okay, now get this. He runs. How great is God? You think this is a problem for any? You think this is a problem for God? All you have to do is be obedient to your call. And you took the first step by being here today, by the way. All right, now, he runs, and the party that he was running in, some party, I don't know which one it was, tried to get him to compromise on principles for the party's sake and not what he thought he was supposed to run on, and he wouldn't do it. And they threatened to kick him off the ballot because he's got to run, it's parliamentary system, got to run on a ballot, on a party. No candidate had run and won the presidency of El Salvador without a party since 1972. And he said, no, I won't compromise. And they kicked him off the ballot. And he said, this is testimony to the world now. And this isn't a closed meeting with evangelicals. And he said, I got kicked off the ballot. And so I said, I went into a back room, kind of depressed. And I said, Lord, what's this? You tell me to run. I'm supposed to run. And this is where it ends up. And then he paused and he said, and I did get an answer. 2 days later, a guy walks in his headquarters and says, you know, again, always, every time, never seen the guy before in his life. No relationship, wasn't introduced through some contact, and says to him, you know, you can get on the ballot with signatures, with a signature petition. We'd have to hurry, but we could probably do it. He said, well, how many would it take? He said, 50,000. So he went back with his teeth. He said, I didn't know what that was. He knew what a signature petition was. Yeah, how would I get 50,000 signatures? The guy said, well, if you'll run, we'll figure that out. The guy comes back 48 hours later with 200,000 signatures. They thought he meant 20,000. He said, no, we got it. He runs, wins with 54% of the vote without a runoff, multiple candidates, and is the first guy elected president since 1972 without a party. And then, you know what? He closed by saying, it's time to get back to God's principles in government and give government back to God. And he walked off the stage. He's raising people up like that. They're out there. I can sense it. This is coming. All we have to do is what we're called to do, each one of us. Now, I missed one point, Dennis. I was going to tell real quick. Between the United States and China, Deng Xiaoping went through his decision-making process on how he decided to deregulate the banks, reestablish the stock exchange. And the third component was to have the price of the yuan tied to a world price for the staple of society, which was rice. And he was close to the Soviet Union, what they were doing, and said, I will not fly the plane in the ground. Remember that quote. He said, when the nose goes down, I won't. I'll pull it up. And so he tied it to the new Hong Kong dollar, part of what I was doing with the stock exchange. Okay, not to bore with all those details. I said, when did you make the decision that communism doesn't work economically, but does politically? And remember the G7? When they formed the G7, what did I tell you they formed it for? To coordinate fiat currency so they could print more of it. You know what that year was? 1976. Both of them, China and the United States, both made the wrong decision on currency management. And here we are today. I don't think that's by accident, spiritually. All right, look, all we have to do is first believe that God created this and created each one of us, that we are here for a special purpose in this time. And then the next thing you have to do is serve with joy. Now let's go back to those fourth century Christians. You probably haven't heard me say this. I think it was the other group I said this to. The greatest time in evangelical history of numbers coming forward was the 4th century AD when Rome was crumbling. There were no services. There was no confidence in government. People had nowhere to go. Complete disorder. Lasts for about 100 years, by the way. But still, people were desperate. And the only source of recourse was the Christian New Testament church. And they served Sumerians, Jews, Arabs, Philistines, didn't matter. And you weren't asked when you walked in the door, what's your faith? You were asked, what do you need? And it converted the world. Constantine became Christian. And what happened, and what we have to do, the ancient world, if you can see that fulcrum of Rome, it all teeters on that, by the way. There's a whole other thought process to go through on that, why Jesus came then and pulling through the Old Testament to the New Testament and what Jesus meant how he changed the laws, but he didn't ignore the Old Testament laws on economics, government, and business, moving it forward, is that in all of this, there is consistency if you believe in the Lord's word and that he's the same in the past, in the present, and the future. Now, the other thing that I sense, I just close my eyes and I can see it, is any of us could relate to 4th century Christians. You know what else they did? They were at peace. God's got this. Come join us. Feel the peace of Christ. Feel the joy that there's nothing out there but us and we're going to do this together. And they were loyal to their call and we're here today because of it. And all we can do now is the same thing. So listen, I commend you for being here. It means a lot to me that you take the time to come and be part of this and be loyal to God's call. The world needs you. It needs us. It needs our joy and our peace in projecting and reflecting Christ. Thank you very much.
This is a copyrighted program of Go Strategic, Santa Rosa, California. Unauthorized reproduction is prohibited. Go Strategic is an international nonprofit organization that educates and equips leaders and others for effective service and leadership using biblical principles. For more information, visit us online at www.gostrategic.org.